You're listening to the Takeaway Podcast. You can also chat with us on Twitter by going to twitter.com/thetakeaway.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And with all the holiday reunions going on right now, we want to specifically reach out to every parent filled with pride and joy at seeing a returning college student home for the Christmas break, some for the very first time, and to each one of those returning students as well. Amidst the joy of a child's first experiences away from home, there's the sudden immense pressure to succeed. Complicated romantic relationships, perhaps an insecurity about the future kept deep inside. For parents, there's a blind spot, the sense that turmoil inside their own child may be clouded by a pride. They've all grown up, made it to college, have a whole new life far from home. They don't want me poking around in their lives, a parent concludes. Well, why mention this? One of the leading causes of death, and a rising one for teens in America, is suicide. Nearly half of all college students report in surveys they've had more than just idle suicidal thoughts. One in three first-year students won't make it back to campus for their sophomore year, according to U.S. News and World Report. And yet the availability of mental health services for young people in the U.S. at this critical time is pitiful at best, as we'll learn now. Donna and Phil Satow came into our studios this week and generously and heroically bared their souls to remind all of us just what may be at stake for young people and their parents right now. They co-founded the Jed Foundation in 2000 after their youngest son, Jed, without warning, committed suicide during his sophomore year of college. It is to Jed that we want to dedicate this hour. The Satows also introduced us to young college graduate Misha Kessler, who's alive today almost by accident. That is how close he came to a single desperate act. These three people's pain, courage, and determination in speaking to all of us so candidly was simply breathtaking. Listen, Misha Kessler begins.
It's terrifying, absolutely terrifying. From my personal experiences, it was such a roller coaster, and it started out smoother and would slowly progress until you just didn't understand the complexities and the seriousness of the emotional instability that you were facing. And when it came to talking to other people about it, certainly the stigma was very silencing, very silencing.
So you were afraid to tell people that, hey, I feel like there's something wrong with me, or I'm depressed, or...
Absolutely.
What is it? All the
Absolutely,
above?
Absolutely, yes. It was fear of labeling, I think, mostly. I think it's a very lonely thing. You think you are isolated. You think you're being a burden on others. You're trying to hide what you're really feeling. Mm-hmm. Absolutely overwhelming.
How close did you come?
I was on the ledge of a windowsill on, I think it was the sixth floor. And I remember thinking to myself, telling myself to just let go, aim for the metal hut, head first.
And why are you here?
There was one moment that forced me to turn around from the window, and I climbed back into my room, having the realization that I absolutely hated myself. And it took that realization, it took the understanding that this was something so much more than any kind of intentional thought could help, because it was so ingrained in my mind that I hated myself. So once I had that realization, I started working on loving myself, and I think that's what ultimately saved me.
And you got help?
I got help. Went to a hospital.
Now, the moment that Misha is describing, Donna, is a moment that more than anything you wish your son...
Absolutely. I wasn't as fortunate. Yes.
Can you describe what happened to Jed?
Yeah. It's interesting that we're here today because it was 15 years ago, this Christmas break, on a Christmas break, that this happened in our family. And I unfortunately was the person who got the call that something had happened. I think how Misha describes it is very, very true, that I think a young person, my son in particular, seemed very outgoing. He seemed to have friends. He seemed to be doing all right. But there was a private, darker side that he was very unwilling to share. And something came over my son, who happened to be alone in a small little weekend vacation spot that we had. He was with friends and home for the holiday, and he broke up with a girlfriend. And whereas Jed was gifted, he was very impulsive, and he had a sensitive heart, I think. And he did an impulsive act that there was no turning back from.
Phil, what was that impulsive act?
Jed hanged himself 14 years this month, and it indeed was an impulsive act. And he was with a friend hours before, but the dissolution of his relationship with this young woman was the trigger that acted on his impulsive nature, and it unfortunately resulted in his death.
I was just going to say that someone said to me after Janet died that he had a mental illness, and I said, "No, no, it's not possible. He was, you know, he was fine." I think so little is understood today by parents, and I don't know if a good job is done to understand how depression or the beginnings of an emotional problem look in a person who's 18, 19, 20. I think we're getting much better, but I think that's a big problem.
So, Phil, what infrastructure is it your mission to try to create on campuses around the United States to prevent what happened to your son?
Well, I think it's important that there are safeguards on a campus. Specifically, a school should have a rational medical leave policy that students are aware of, so they're not afraid to come forward with a problem because they may think they'll be thrown out of school. A rational leave policy might assure that they can get help outside and then come back to campus at the appropriate time. A parental notification policy. There should be a policy like that on a campus so parents will know before they send a child to college that under certain circumstances they will hear from that university. That's an important safeguard. It's important that there's 24-hour coverage. If students like Misha have an issue in the middle of the night, there has to be a place that people can go. That's also essential. And then, of course, it's essential that there's appropriate training. Training among the student body itself so that they know what to look for in their friends and they know when it's important to insist that their friends get help.
So how enthusiastic have colleges been to work with you to develop practices that will achieve some of these goals, Phil?
I think the counseling centers and the deans of students are very excited and enthusiastic to work with us. I think there's an existing feeling outside of those centers of activity that, oh, the problem can be taken care of by the dean of students or the head of the counseling center. And it's important that senior people in universities, the presidents themselves, the provosts, the heads of academic departments recognize that it's a communal problem and that indeed if these safeguards aren't in place, it not only will affect the safety of the campus, but it will affect the academic performance because one of the leading reasons why kids might drop out of school is that they have emotional problems and they can't handle the academics.
And the consequence is that it just makes all this much easier if it's above board, right, Misha?
Absolutely. Absolutely. If I may add on, actually, I think why I would see a program such as Jed Campus being vital to these universities, from my own story, there were so many things that, looking back, could have been so easily resolved, such as when I first tried to speak to my parents about how I thought I really needed help. I needed a psychiatrist and a therapist. And my parents didn't respond too well at first, understandably. I think it scared them. It scared them what it would mean for me. And beyond that, because I was on an allowance as a college student, my university counseling center's fees were $50 a session. I absolutely couldn't handle that without an increase in allowance from my parents. So I ended up going to a local, basically it was a program for master's and PhD students in psychology. And I got a counselor there for $10 a session. But there they didn't have an adequate communication system. So if I ever had a panic attack, an emergency, I wouldn't be able to talk to my therapist. Going forward, there weren't window locks, so I could open my window more than 6 inches. There were all these issues that could have been resolved, and that's why we need to have a program like Jed Campus that is going out there and telling the universities to lower their counseling fees, to increase the safety precautions, things such as that.
When was your Ledge experience?
How long was it? Actually quite timely, January 18th, so coming up on 3 years.
3 years.
Yeah.
In that time, have you helped to pull anyone back from a ledge, figuratively or literally?
Yeah, both. I know tons of people who have had these experiences themselves. And it's something as simple as receiving a message at 3 a.m. on Facebook and someone saying, I actually think I might harm myself, which has happened before on many occasions. Generally, I go to them. I'll find them wherever they are, and then we talk. Because the thing for me when I was in my darkest time was that logically or intellectually I could know that I had a future and that I had a good future. I was a college student. I would have an undergraduate degree. But emotionally, I was blind to my future, such that I was so convinced that there was nothing beyond the anxiety that I was feeling at that moment. There was nothing beyond this deep, dark cloud that I've been suffering under.
Phil, finally, before we go, I can't imagine your loss. Yet, you picked yourself up and started this journey, this mission. It's taken 14, 15 years. You're starting to see some real success. How did you do that?
For me, it's two issues. I know Donna feels the same way, that we would do anything to prevent another parent from experiencing what we had to experience. We would do anything. On the other hand, there's another issue, and that is that as a parent, honestly, I'll always have a degree of guilt for what happened, and that I'm a father, and a father's job is to take care of their children. And my son, I lost a son. That'll always exist, and I would do anything to help others to not have the same feelings that Donna and I have had to cope with over these years.
Well, Donna, Phil, and Misha, thanks so much.
Thanks, Sean.
Thank you.
Phil and Donna Sato are the co-founders of the Jed Foundation. It's an organization they started in 2000 after they lost their son, Jed, to suicide. Misha Kessler is the winner of the 2013 Jerry Greenspan Student Voice of Mental Health Award. To find out more about the Jed Foundation, call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or visit our website, thetakeaway.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International, in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
On quite another note this holiday week, little tin horns and little toy drums, little toy dolls that cuddle and coo, elephants, boats, and kitty cars too. Isn't that how it goes from the official song, Santa Claus Coming to Town? But if Santa showed up with that stuff in 2013, I mean, there'd be a lot of pouting. Once upon a time, toys were just toys until they became electronic toys. My first electronic gift was a transistor radio, lo these many years ago, made by Sharp, and a set of 100-milliwatt walkie-talkies. We've made some progress technologically in the years since I was impressed by that radio, so much so that my kids ask these days, "What's a radio, Dad?" Thanks for that. Gerardo writes on Facebook that his favorite electronic toy was his Game Boy. Traditional Sandy is sticking with her Legos and Lincoln Logs. Legos, by the way, have gone completely techie with the times, have you noticed? Listener Zach loved his Mr. Potato Head, who went on to have a movie career in the Pixar flicks Toy Story. Well, Manoush Zomorodi is here now with some advice on making your tech toy choices more intelligent, avoiding the carnage of Grand Theft Auto, and encouraging creativity without making the whole tech toy experience feel like an educational public radio podcast. By the way, Manoush is host and managing editor of WNYC's podcast, New Tech City. Manoush, welcome.
Great to be here, John, as always.
All my kids talk about are electronic tech toys and new phones, headphones, tablets. What's a daddy to do?
Yeah, well, you know what? Here's the thing, John. I've decided to take this opportunity to try to convince you to redefine what a tech toy actually is. Because if you go online, you'll see, first of all, the number one seller this year for a gift is indeed a tablet. And if you look up best tech toys, they're usually writing something like there's this robotic puppy that's really big on the list right now, or a scooter that's an electric scooter. And these are what are considered tech toys. But really, what we should be thinking is that a tech toy, yes, it makes sure that a kid is having fun and is totally engaged, but that it's working on their brain as well, their spatial and logical reasoning, their executive functioning, their hand-eye coordination. Not that they're just pushing a button and watching machine do something, but what about the kid? What are he or she doing?
Now, that doesn't sound like so much Santa Claus as it does kind of Dr. Claus.
Am I sounding too worthy here?
Well, I don't know. I mean, are the kids really going to respond to something that's like, you know, a tablet that also juggles and plays Mozart and helps their brains?
Okay.
You know?
I hear your fears here. Yeah. And so what I've done is I've found some examples for different age groups.
All right.
And here's my criteria, right? They're not going to be over $100. Most of these, $100.
Okay.
Most of these are under $50. They require brain power.
Okay.
And they are fun. Okay,
fine.
So let's start with the little ones. Mine are getting older, but you've done these before. Magformers or magnetiles. These are clear plastic squares that have magnets on them. And seriously, kids can build for hours. And they don't have the frustration of some of the other things that you build with because you don't need, you know, the little ones, they don't have the, sometimes they can't push the Legos together
right, or things like that.
These you can actually see buildings come to life or create little boxes or all and
because
fill
they
them
have magnets.
With.
They,
exactly.
Right. Yeah, yeah. All right. And you don't lose them. And if you lose like six of them, then it's useless. And they stay together. They're
infinite.
Infinite.
Exactly.
Right.
Infinite. You
Very
can
good.
Keep going. They are not cheap. This is definitely something that's a bit of a investment, but I think it's worth it. So that's, you know, for the little ones. Let's keep going with that, though. One of the biggest things at schools right now is the rainbow loom. And I've decided, you know what, my little boy, how come all the girls get to have the fun with the rainbow loom? I'm getting that for my little guy because he gets some occupational therapy. This is great for fine motor skills and creativity.
It's literally a loom, right? I mean,
it's literally a loom.
So you're doing the warp and the weft and the...
Yeah. Low-tech loom with rubber bands, but good for fine motor skills and for spatial reasoning.
As a parent, just a little piece of advice.
Yeah.
I just wouldn't say occupational therapy when you give him the gift. Okay, just
don't go there?
Yeah, just don't go there.
No,
we need to.
Are you kidding? We're going to set up a rainbow loom shop in the living room, make one for everyone.
Nice.
He's going to be the master of his own
domain. Keep going.
Okay, so the other thing that I love are these new kits that come that actually are electronics. So one is called Snap Circuits Junior Electronics Projects Kit. It's a really long name.
Now, these are what age here?
Okay, so school age. So like, you know, 8 to 12 kind of thing.
Yeah, okay,
yeah.
Great.
So they have over 100 projects that you can make with this. You can use the circuits, the motors, and the switches to make something like an AM radio or a sound-controlled switch. Or you could make an alarm that if your nosy little brother opens a drawer, the alarm goes off.
No, my son loves these. We've picked up some of this stuff at maker fairs, and they're very, very popular in the sort of maker culture. But they're moving out and becoming more of a mainstream thing.
That's absolutely right. Goldieblocks is another one that was the number one seller on Amazon, actually. And this came from a woman who was, an MIT engineer. So this one's aimed at girls, which kind of annoys me, but that's another segment, I think. What you do with Goldieblocks is you build these spinning machines. They're basically wheels on pegs, and they're bound with ribbon, and you do it according to this story. She has to build machines, I think, to travel through the story. All right, you want some more?
Keep going.
These marble things are so cool. You build basically roller coasters for marbles. You can make the craziest machines with these 250 pieces, right? And you set it up and it can like spin and fly through the air and you can – it's just –
So wait, it's a track for a marble.
Exactly.
And you create the pathways and it goes up, down. So it's kind of like the dominoes thing, only there's less setup.
More setup more crazy variation because you don't have to stay on the ground. You can go up and over and around.
And again, if you lose one piece, is the thing useless?
No, dude. These are infinite. Keep going.
Modularity.
Exactly.
Okay,
that's what's in. Okay, right. So now the tweens, right? A little bit older here. Yeah. This is an expensive one, but I've heard people say that it is one that keeps giving. It's the Lego Mindstorms. Have you done
those?
Yeah,
they're great. No, they're fantastic.
They're not cheap, though.
No, they're not cheap.
And then another place that I want to send people is this 3D printing company called Shapeways. You can go on there and create your own thing. They will print it out for you and mail it to you. I made a New Tech City ring. I know you're very impressed.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess the mission here and the takeaway is really think way beyond tablets and Kindles. The tech opportunities for play are burgeoning and limitless.
Yeah, exactly. And I think also, you know, if you're like me and all you can do is press the button, right? I think what we're talking about is building skills, right, in kids, instead of being like, oh, you press that button, in 5 years you're going to be able to press even more buttons, right? Build the damn buttons yourselves. That's what we're saying.
All right. Manoush, thanks so much.
Great to be here, John.
Manoush Zamarodi is the host and managing editor of WNYC's New Tech City. And to see a full list of recommendations, visit our website at thetakeaway.org. A message to the world now from Russian President Vladimir Putin. Don't rain on my Winter Olympics parade. Putin held an unusual extended news conference to announce a broad political amnesty, the main event of which will be to free one of his most significant political rivals, Mikhail Khodorkovsky, the famed Russian oil tycoon and oligarch who's been in prison for a decade. Putin cited humanitarian principles for the unexpected pardon. Joining us from Moscow is Fred Weir, Moscow correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. Welcome, Fred.
Hello, John.
So I love this humanitarian principles business here. Is this kind of a case of free at last from Vladimir Putin?
Well, I think the general consensus is that it's a PR move on the eve of the Sochi Winter Games, because there had been a lot of bad publicity for Russia, to put it mildly. And with this release of Khodorkovsky, the former oil tycoon, and a sweeping amnesty that releases a lot of the political prisoners, also on sort of general goodwill grounds, Putin has removed in one fell swoop most of the most irritating cases, the cases that constantly come up in talking points when Western leaders come and visit and in media articles about Putin's Russia. He simply removed them. People won't be able to talk about them in the same way anymore. And that does, I think everybody agrees, whatever his motives were, that really does clear the air a lot.
Although, if I may just push back a little bit, I mean, if he really wanted the PR gesture, he would have freed the folks from Pussy Riot, right? I mean, freeing a billionaire doesn't exactly, you know, win you a lot of acreage in heaven.
The amnesty, which was passed by the State Duma on Wednesday, will almost certainly free the two Pussy Riot women and also the 30 Greenpeace activists who've been held. They're on trial, but the amnesty was specifically constructed to apply to people who are on trial. So there's no doubt that it is more sweeping than just Khodorkovsky. But of course, Khodorkovsky is the headline. He remains the single most famous and important political prisoner in Russia, and his release does move the needle, at least temporarily.
Is Khodorkovsky the headline in Putin's mind or in the mind of the Russian people, who now can think very differently about the political landscape going forward?
I think that Putin did not feel well about releasing Khodorkovsky. The fact is that yesterday he gave a four-hour press conference through which we all sat patiently. He was even asked a question about Khodorkovsky, and he did not mention that he was preparing to release him. It means that he was not comfortable with this information. He knew that everyone would get excited, and so he didn't tell us during the press conference. He told a few reporters afterwards as he was leaving, as if it was almost an afterthought. So Putin definitely is, though we can't really read his mind, he's clearly ambivalent about Khodorkovsky, but he felt like he had to do this, I think, because so many world leaders, including President Obama, have declined to come to the opening ceremonies of the Olympic Games. And that's a very abnormal situation. And it clearly one that made Putin feel snubbed and probably prompted him to take these steps.
So it's a restatement of the old rule, keep your friends close and your enemies closer at this point.
Well, we don't know what's going to happen with Khodorkovsky. We know that he's been let free, so it's a real deal. We're not sure the circumstances of the deal under which he was released. Putin said it was for humanitarian reasons and that he had asked for clemency. Khodorkovsky's lawyers say he did not ask for a pardon. A pardon would imply an admission of guilt. But it's probable that he did ask for clemency, which merely means, you know, I'm asking you to go easy on me. And if that's the case, that then Khodorkovsky may come back and he may very well go into politics again. He should be free to do so. And that could change the political landscape in this country.
Fred Weir, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Fred Weir is Moscow correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. Another message in the form of pardons was delivered yesterday by President Obama, commuting the sentences of eight people convicted on federal crack cocaine charges. It comes as the administration has fought to curb mandatory minimum sentences for certain low-level nonviolent drug offenders. In addition to these eight lucky ones, 500,000 people remain behind bars across the U.S. for drug law violations at the federal and state level. Joining us now is Mark Osler, a law professor at the University of St. Thomas in Minneapolis, where he runs a law clinic on sentencing and commutations. Welcome, Professor.
Thanks for having me.
So this commuting of sentences is different than a presidential pardon. Can you explain?
It falls under the president's pardon power in the Constitution, but it does something different. And that is that pardons are usually used when someone has served their term and it restores some of their rights. With a commutation of sentence, it shortens a sentence that's currently being served. So what we saw the president do yesterday was shorten the sentences of a number of people who are doing very long terms for crack cocaine offenses.
Now, there's, you know, a half million people who might come under the same category of these people that the president decided to focus on. And in the Constitution, he actually has the power to commute all of their sentences, right? To enact this reform in like one fell swoop.
That is only true for federal sentences. State governors and in a few instances, legislatures have that ability in the states, but the president can only do this for federal prisoners. And so we're looking at a smaller number, but still very significant.
So does something like this send a message to judges, to prosecutors, to legislatures, to change the law, to take a look at either on the front end, the kinds of prosecutions they choose? Or are we really talking about a reform movement within the corrections system that the president has limited power to influence?
Great question, because I think that the message the president is sending here may be the most important thing about these commutations, because they all are long-term crack cases. And what he's doing is saying that he's willing to act under his executive authority under the Constitution to shorten those sentences. Now, importantly, this is something that all three branches of government has already agreed is a problem, that Congress changed the law relating to crack sentencing, made those sentences shorter, that the Supreme Court, in a series of opinions, was very critical of the old crack laws, and now the executive is weighing in very strongly.
What is the precedent for the president using his pardon powers, which, as you noted, were... You know, we were so familiar with the kind of last hour of the administration, pardons of friends and various folks, and it's all kind of random and sometimes very scandalous. But using that pardon power to actually critique the criminal justice system and to encourage actual reform.
It's something that President Kennedy did most significantly, specifically related to narcotics, that with his attorney general, his brother Robert, they did act under the pardon power in a number of narcotics cases, many of them involving marijuana laws when those laws were especially harsh. There's also an analogy to war here, because after major wars, we've seen a broad use of the pardon power after World War II, after World War I, the Korean War, and even after Vietnam. President Ford had a special commission, a presidential clemency board, that granted a large number of pardons. Maybe what we're seeing now is the same kind of thing in the wake of the war on drugs.
Well, using the Kennedy example, since Attorney General Robert Kennedy was very involved in that decision, how much is this really the hand and message of Eric Holder, the Attorney General under President Obama?
It's certainly consistent with what Attorney General Holder has been saying recently, which is that he wants to address some of the excesses of the justice system, especially relating to narcotics crimes. He's taken steps in August to try to guide the discretion of his prosecutors, and I used to be one of those prosecutors, as they make charging decisions. And certainly because these decisions came up through the Attorney General, he agreed with them. Hmm. And he's sending the message at the other end that we need to consider mercy and compassion at that end as well.
Mark Osler is a former federal prosecutor, now a law professor at the University of St. Thomas, where he runs the country's only law school clinic for commutations. Mark Osler, thanks so much.
Thank you.
He was such a Dickens fan, that Miles Davis. That's his Great Expectations. Later in the hour, actor Ralph Fiennes becomes Charles Dickens in his new movie, The Invisible Woman, a story about the author that you probably don't know, as well as the one about Scrooge, Little Dorrit, Charles Darnay, David Copperfield. Have you got a Dickens fave for our time?
My name is Bill Korsak, calling from Southfield, suburb of Detroit, Michigan. Tale of Two Economies, I mean, Tale of Two Cities, because it was the best of times. Hopefully we're over the worst of times and things are getting better.
Danny Simon from West Bloomfield, Michigan. Dickens' character, Mr. Myrtle, from Little Dorrit, is so Bernie Madoff, it's uncanny.
Love to know your Dickens faves. All right, there's a lot to choose from. Call us at 8778-MY-TAKE or post a comment to thetakeaway.org.
I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!
I'm Spartacus! I'm Spartacus!
I'm Spartacus!
No more! Hang on!
I'm trying to use the phone!
Hey, Christmas is all about the movies, right? That's really all that's going on. Hollywood releases some of the biggest films this week, this weekend. We're going to talk with Rafer Guzman and Kristen Meinzer. Rafer, of course, film critic for Newsday. Kristen Meinzer, culture producer for The Takeaway. They both are the Movie Date podcast. Welcome.
Hi. Hi, John.
And let's get started with a little bit of American history in the form of American Hustle.
You're going to do this because you got no choice. You work for me.
You keep changing the rules. You know, you're getting a little power drunk. Richard, you know, you want to tell him anything? You want to wake him up?
Oh, no, I said we shouldn't do any of it, Irving. You know I said that. So now I support Richie. He's got vision. Do it heavy or don't do it.
I mean, he's the one ruling America, not me.
This is an unbelievable cast. Christian Bale, Amy Adams, Bradley Cooper, Jennifer Lawrence. Renner's in this, right?
Yep. Yes.
This is all about a controversial program that nailed a bunch of congressmen back in the 1980s. It was called Abscam at the time, in a particularly racist moment yes. of the FBI and investigators. Rafer, what do you think?
Well, this movie's been getting a lot of Oscar traction and a lot of awards traction lately, and I think there's a reason why. It's really fun, upbeat, energetic movie. It's got a great cast, as you say. Everyone is just completely on fire. Jennifer Lawrence, possible Oscar winner again for supporting actress. I don't think it's quite as topical or as deep as you might want it to be, but I think it's really fun. It's like a good old-fashioned Hollywood movie.
Ocean's 11 meets All the President's Men, Kristen?
I think it's really, really terrific, and I wouldn't be upset if it ends up being an Oscar contender. I think it's so smart. It's so beautifully crafted. And to take it above other heist movies, each of the characters is so well drawn, so complicated, so intricate. And you don't normally see these kinds of characters in a heist movie. Each character is so fascinating. I could just watch a movie about each one.
What did you think of the history? I mean, it ended up nailing a senator and some congressmen over bribes. It was all involving people posing as Arab sheikhs and other sorts of unsavory characters. Did the history – I mean, you probably weren't born at the time, of course, but what?
Well, it's a lot of fun. They opened the movie with just a one sentence disclaimer, some of the following events are true. So I think that was the sentence.
They say, some of this actually happened, is what they say. Very loosely based on the ABSCAM.
All right, which is a great segue to just how much we hate broadcast journalism in America. And one evidence of that is that there's a sequel to Anchorman called Anchorman 2.
Mr. Burgundy, we're starting a 24-hour news channel. First of its kind, GNN.
That is without a doubt the dumbest thing I've ever heard. You mean news going 24 hours around the clock? A channel that's never off, in other words.
Yeah. Just 24 hours.
So does this work a second time around? The build-up for this, Ron Burgundy's appearances everywhere on ESPN, everywhere, is unbelievably, like, the penetration is maximum. What do you think?
Oh, I love Ron Burgundy, and I'm one of the people who's very, very excited to have him back again. However, this was not the best way to have him back. A lot of this movie is drawn out, slow, not funny. Some of it actually felt like a bad Saturday Night Live skit that you wish would just end. The writers just didn't know when to quit. There were a few chuckly moments here and there, but it does not stand up to the original.
I mean, one of the things that's amazing here, let's listen. In the movie, there's a joke that Ron Burgundy was making quite a while ago.
All around the clock, sports all the time.
That's the concept of the news.
Oh, that's never going to work. That's ridiculous. I mean, that's like a 24-hour cooking network or an all-music channel.
So he's making that joke like in 2012 on ESPN. This is recycled material, Rafer?
Some of it feels a little bit outdated, but the movie only takes place in 1980. So they've really only updated the Ron Burgundy character just a little bit, I think mostly so they can keep the costumes. I think the one thing that I disliked about this movie is there's some racial humor in this film. He dates a character played by Megan Good. There's a scene where she takes him to dinner and he tries to get down with her family by speaking the way he thinks black people speak. It didn't quite work for me in 2013. I felt like that was a little off to me.
My feeling is that we're kind of over this trashing of broadcast TV, and The Daily Show does it every single night. So it's kind of like territory that's sort of over.
Yeah, that's one thing. I think, what Ron Burgundy becomes in a way is a bit of a Bill O'Reilly type bloviator.
Which Colbert has already done,
exactly. So there is that problem, too. But I think there are some fun moments. And when you get the actors, Paul Rudd and Steve Carell, when they're all just sort of in there mixing it up, it can be pretty funny.
Maybe the franchises do a send-up of the Movie Date podcast, eh, Kristen? Who would play you? The final film here, Her. This is Spike Jonze.
How do you share your life with somebody?
Well, we grew up together. I used to read all of her writing all through her master's and PhD. And she read every word I ever wrote. We were a big influence on each other. I still find myself having conversations with her in my mind.
Scarlett Johansson, Joaquin Phoenix. Kristen, what do you think?
So what's happening in this movie is Joaquin Phoenix is a newly single man who gets a new operating system for his computer in the very near future, falls in love with the operating system that is voiced by Scarlett Johansson and the complications of their relationship.
Very quickly, does it work? Kristen?
I thought it was a little too slow, a little too sad, and a little too repetitive.
Rafer?
I think it's one of the most amazing movies I've seen in years.
Whoa!
I think
love
it's fantastic.
And on the podcast?
This week we have a real artificial intelligence expert who's going to weigh in on whether or not Her is a realistic story.
Well, have a happy holiday, you guys. Rafer Guzman, Kristen Meinzer, the Movie Date podcast. Rafer, film critic for Newsday. Kristen, culture producer for The Takeaway. Happy holidays, guys.
Thanks so much, John.
The Takeaway is supported by Lumosity.com, the brain training program designed by neuroscientists and used by 50 million people, created to improve memory and attention. More at Lumosity.com.
Every year at this time, it seems as though author Charles Dickens comes alive.
He seemed to leap up into it with a mighty bound, and the ship was gone.
Truly, Mr. Dickens, it is never so alive as when it is spoken by its author.
Thank you.
Mr. Dickens! Mr. Dickens!
Hello. Thank you.
He was the most famous celebrity of his time, far beyond a mere writer. The yearly retelling of A Christmas Carol is just one of the echoes of Dickens in our time. A new movie opening Christmas Day, you just heard a bit of it there, brings us into the life of Dickens in a story he could never tell. The charming, charismatic celebrity, a doting father of 10 children, was also the man who maintained an affair for 18 years with a woman less than half his age. Actress Ellen Ternan became Dickens' lover when she was 18 and he was 45. That is the story told in the new movie, The Invisible Woman.
Nellie, it was a mistake.
Did you send Catherine to me?
Yes.
She is the mother of your children. How could you be so cruel to her?
And for that, I shall always be grateful. But I do not love her. She comprehends nothing. She sees nothing. I thought if she saw you, then she would understand that I have nothing with her. I wanted her to see it.
It? What is it, Charles? What is it that we are?
The Invisible Woman stars two-time Oscar nominee Ralph Fiennes as Dickens, who also directed the film. Fiennes says in playing Dickens, he wanted also to inhabit the morally contradictory times of the Victorian era and take the audience into it with him.
I wanted to avoid what I felt were the stereotypes or the tropes of period love affairs where you sort of feel the hearts beating and pulsating from the first scene on, and there are sort of yearning looks across a room and the music surges. I felt this film should chart delicately the stages of relationship. For me, there were all these little details that it's in the design of rooms, it's in the way things are lit, in the way people move. Yes, the ease of physical contact that we are used to today wasn't the case, I don't think, then. But in fact, the so-called physical restraint of people with each other, I think, adds an eroticism in effect.
Well, completely.
Because the stakes are higher all the time.
And we don't sing around the piano. Yeah. It's a headphone world that we live in. And there's so much social intensity in these scenes, and yet the restraint.
Yeah. Well, that's it. That was what I wanted to explore. And I was lucky to have, in this case, a great actress at the center of it, young Felicity Jones, who plays Nellie. So we should probably talk about her because she is the heart of the film. And she brilliantly, what I love about Felicity is that she suggests a very rich and complex interior. She really does inhabit something, but she keeps it back like someone with a strong hand of cards who's waiting for the moment to play them. And we're fascinated to know what's going on inside.
And a volcano within, in many ways. She's so in love with Dickens's writing. It seems like they are destined to get together on some level.
Yes, she was in love with Dickens. She walked into his life. She seemed to me to encapsulate the sort of almost overly perfect feminine heroines that he writes in his earlier books, in sad contrast to his wife Catherine, who, after 20 years of marriage, I think, couldn't keep up with his furious, boyish, willful energy and had been pregnant every year of their life. And I think that she was tired.
A tough character. She's sympathetic, even in her tired and worn out and passionlessness that doesn't simply put her in a category, it seems.
No, well, it's the interpretation of Catherine is enriched by the brilliant Joanna Scanlon. There's a great scene at the center of this film where Catherine Dickens returns a present, a bracelet, to Nellie, misdirected to Catherine. The jeweller has made the bracelet thinking it's for Dickens' wife, so Catherine returns this bracelet in a very painful scene. You know, the wife and the other woman meet. When Joanna Scanlon came to read this, she for me absolutely nailed this level of dignity and restraint, but underneath it was you felt terrible, terrible pain. At some level, she knows she's losing her husband. Mm. But she articulates something really interesting, which I think is very close to the truth. She says to Nellie, "You will never know whether it's you or his public he loves the most." And I think this is one of the central elements. A man who feels himself defined by his public. Mm. People say, why did he, the way he left Catherine Dickens after 20-odd years of marriage, abruptly, never really spoke to her again, wrote to her maybe twice after that, in fact instructed his children not to have any contact with their mother. I think his cruel behaviour and his heartbreaking behaviour was that he couldn't confront himself on what the result is. If you leave a relationship and leave a marriage with children, you're going to be a mess. He made himself publicly the victim. The thing that kept him going was these public readings. He loved, I think, contact with an audience and to feel an audience's response.
And accounts of those readings are legendary. Mm. And the readings in this movie, you really see he's the original multimedia man. He's his own celebrity. He's completely in command of it.
Constantly putting out written material, not only his novels, but he edited these weekly or monthly magazines. And his letter, I mean, I bought all the 12 volumes of Dickens' letters.
Well, I won't quiz you on the letters, I promise. One of the last lines in this movie, and I'm not giving anything away, is about how Great Expectations has two endings because of the emotional quality of the original ending, and he changed it at the behest of somebody, at least according to the story. In this story with Nell, he could not write two endings.
No.
He lost that control, and that's really the tragedy here in the end.
Well, the film is really about how Nellie Ternan became the mistress, and there are two time scales in the film. So the first one is the present day. Nellie, we meet Nellie after Dickens has been in her life. So for me, that part is about how Nellie Ternan finds closure with herself about Dickens. Then back in time, the story of Dickens and Nellie is how the stages whereby Nellie agreed to be the mistress. Because what interested me mostly was what were the stages whereby this young woman agreed to become a mistress.
Would you say that the cost these characters bear comes from the Victorian era and the rules that are set down? Or is the cost that Nellie pays for all of this because Dickens on some level is a kind of a predator?
I don't think Dickens is a philanderer. I don't think he's normally a man who finds a sort of predatory role in regards to women. I think that he was smitten, and I think it was a genuine infatuation and passionate love in the end.
Did you admire the character of Dickens that you inhabited? Do you wish that you could be that much the center of attention?
Well, I think Dickens fascinates me in all his totality, and I admire much about him. I think when we seek to appraise famous people, I think sometimes our language is quite impoverished because we go, was he good? Was he bad? Was he a bit deviant? Wasn't very loyal to his wife? He betrayed so-and-so. He drank a lot or whatever. And I think sometimes the totality of someone, especially if they are of the creative stature of Dickens and what they're carrying, I think we lose sight of. And alongside that, I think Dickens, you know, was a very loyal friend. He was incredibly supportive and helpful to many, many people. His letters are full of concerns for the well-being of others. And he came through for people.
Well, so much there. Ray Fiennes, thanks so much.
Thank you. Thank you. Likewise.
Ray Fiennes directed and starred in the upcoming film The Invisible Woman. It's the true story of Charles Dickens. It opens in theaters on Christmas Day. Lots to choose from Charles Dickens' books. What novel is still relevant today? From St. Louis, Missouri, Oliver Twist. It's about respecting the work of each person as an individual apart from education or social status. Give us your story at 8778-MY-TAKE. Send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.